be seated.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Michael Robinson from the law firm of Richard Slade & Sabin, and I rise today to introduce Michael Cooper of Sullivan & Cromwell, who will be arguing on behalf of the defendants today.
Welcome, Mr. Cooper.
Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, this is the time the court has set down for the en banc oral argument case number 218. Before I begin, I'm pleased to introduce to the court Ms. Laura Gundersheim of our New York office, who provided substantial help in the briefing and preparation for today's argument.
Welcome.
May it please the court, plaintiffs appeal that part of the Chancery Court's decision dismissing plaintiff class action complaint filed against William Harrison, the former chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. The complaint alleged that Harrison violated his fiduciary duty of disclosure in connection with material omissions of fact contained in the joint proxy statement that JPMC and Bank One circulated to garner shareholder approval of the merger between JPMC and Bank One. Specifically, plaintiffs allege that Harrison violated his fiduciary duty of disclosure by failing to disclose that Diamond, who was the CEO of Bank One, had offered to do the merger with no premium if he could assume the title of CEO and chairman immediately after consummation of the transaction. Harrison rejected that offer, and he was installed as the CEO and chairman of JPMC for a period of 2 years following closing of the transaction. In fact, Mr. Harrison has stepped down before that 2 year period has expired. Now, in the merger, which was a stock-for-stock merger, each shareholder of Bank One received 1.3 shares of JPMC stock, which represented a premium over the unaffected market price of Bank One of $7 billion. The total deal was worth about $57 billion. Now, although this transaction was styled as an acquisition of JPMC of Bank One, it's JPMC shareholders who suffered ownership and voting dilution as a result of this transaction. The board of the newly combined entity was to consist of 16 directors, 8 of whom were JPMC directors and 8 of whom were Bank One directors. Following the transaction, shareholders of JPMC wound up owning approximately 58% of the equity of the new company. But for the payment of the premium to Bank One shareholders in the transaction, shareholders of JPMC would have owned 61% of the newly combined entity. And critically, in this case, the fact of Mr. Diamond's no premium offer was not publicly disclosed until just 4 days before the merger was supposed to be completed, or was completed, which was on July 1st, 2004. The truth was disclosed in a New York Times article, which appeared on Sunday, June 27th. Plaintiffs filed the first action 2 days later on June 29th. Despite awareness of these filings, the defendants went forward and completed the transaction, again, which closed on July 1st. The deal had been approved by the shareholders of JPMC and Bank One on May 25th, so at least a month before. Now, as a result of the alleged wrongdoing, Mr. Harrison got to keep his title as CEO and chairman of the joint entity. He retained his pay, which was not insignificant. He was paid, I believe, approximately close to $20 million in 2004. He also had his contract modified to provide for additional severance in the event of a non-fault termination. The complaint alleges that following the merger, Mr. Diamond serves as the day-to-day head of JPMC, with Harrison taking a largely ceremonial role. And in fact, as I mentioned, Mr. Harrison has already stepped down as chairman and CEO of the combined entity before the 2 years were up. The proxy statement that was circulated to solicit shareholder approval details the negotiations between Harrison and Diamond, including discussion of the employment agreements, but makes no mention of the no-premium offer made by Mr. Diamond. Defendants do not challenge that Mr. Harrison helped prepare the proxy, that he co-authored a letter addressed to shareholders seeking, urging that, urging them to approve the transaction. The two-year employment agreement between Mr. Dime and Mr. Harrison is actually specifically referenced as a factor that both the JPMC and Bank One boards considered and took into account in approving and recommending the merger. Harrison was also questioned about the two-year employment deal by analysts who were following the deal. And in this conversation and questioning neither Mr. Diamond nor Mr. Harrison mentioned anything about the no premium offer.
I realize this is a motion to dismiss. I was looking at the transcript of the oral argument that I didn't participate in. It seems to indicate the parties agree on the record that the board considered this offer and rejected it. Do you agree with that proposition?
I'm bound by what counsel for plaintiffs argued below, which there was a concession that the board had considered the offer, at least was made aware of the offer. But for purposes of this appeal, it's irrelevant, in my opinion, whether they knew or didn't know whether it was concealed for them, because the bottom line is that we're only challenging liability with respect to Harrison, and there's no dispute that Harrison did not make the disclosure to the investing public.
Well, help me understand the focus on Harrison, because I assume ultimately the board was responsible for these materials that were disseminated. Is that correct? Not Harrison alone individually?
Well, the board potentially could be responsible for the disclosures contained in the joint proxy, because there are disclosures in the proxy discussing the board's role, what the board did or didn't do. But Harrison is the one who we say has direct involvement in the drafting and preparation of the proxy. He is the one who authored the letters soliciting shareholder approval of the merger transaction. So we're looking at his liability particularly, especially because it's our allegation that he is the one who was the beneficiary of the non-disclosure of the no premium offer.
So you're looking through his liability particularly or exclusively?
Exclusively with respect to this appeal.
So if you recover, who do you anticipate is going to write you a check if you win?
I would expect that Mr. Harrison would write the check. What that check would be and the amount of that check would vary or depend upon the release sought.
And if this corporation, if we get to discovery and we find out they have a 102B7 provision, will that be relevant from Mr. Harrison's point of view?
Well, I'm sure Mr. Harrison would attempt to claim that he's covered by the 102B7, the 102B7 liability limiting provision. But it's our allegation that the violation of fiduciary duty of disclosure in this case arises out of a violation of fiduciary duty of loyalty, in the sense that he received a benefit, again, the benefit of two additional years as CEO and chair, reputational benefit, and benefit of severance. So,
Mr. Kratzky, the vice chancellor found that the underlying transaction was derivative, that is, gave rise to a derivative claim. You haven't appealed from that ruling, is that correct?
That's correct.
Your sole argument, that is, your sole claim of error on appeal, is that the court erroneously dismissed the duty of disclosure aspect of the claim.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The damages, if any, that would have resulted from the substantive claim would have been a derivative damage, correct? That is a damage that accrued only to JPMC. On the underlying.
Yeah, the only transaction. Obviously, by not appealing, we concede that's true, Your Honor.
Right. So, your position, as I understand it, has to be that the cause of action, that is, the dismissed cause of action for breach of the duty of disclosure, is individual and not derivative, and that the damages flow directly to the class, and I gather only because there would be nominal damages. Is that correct?
Not entirely, Your Honor. We allege that nominal damages would flow directly to the class. But we believe that the court erred in ruling that because the underlying transaction damages were derivative in nature, that plaintiffs couldn't also recover on a damage theory, compensatory damage theory, with respect to the disclosure claims.
Cal, what would the basis for that damage claim be?
The basis for those damage claims was the basis of voting power and economic dilution of their shares. It's our contention that the underlying recovery in this lawsuit, for example, we allege that
the class is, would be entitled to damages equal to the difference between 61% and 58%. That would be your theory.
That would be the theory, Your Honor. And our contention is that if we succeed in a lawsuit under that theory, JPMC, the merged entity, the new entity, is not entitled to recover that in a derivative case because that would unfairly enrich the Bank One shareholders who are now JPMC shareholders. That recovery would flow only to the JPMC shareholders before the transaction was consummated.
But that theory presupposes that there has been actionable voting dilution.
Correct? That's correct. And it's our contention that the voting dilution occurred because of the fact that the shareholders of former shareholders of JPMC own a smaller proportionate share of the combined entity. It's our position that the trial court, the court of chancery, erred by ruling that there had to be a dilution to the point of oblivion similar to what apparently occurred in TriStar, which we don't necessarily agree it happened there.
Would you agree that in this case, that is your disclosure claim, was properly dismissed if there is no right to nominal damages and if the claim for damages, for compensatory damages that you just articulated is foreclosed, that is not contemplated by TriStar or any other case?
Yeah, I would have to concede that if there are no damages available, either nominal damages or no damages were available through compensatory damages, in the theory that we articulate in our papers, we would the dismissal would be proper, I suppose, because we would not have damages to recover.
So is it fair to conclude that the damage, those two damages issues are the focus of this appeal, that is, are the sole issues that are presented to us?
That is the core of our appeal, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. This case reminded me of Arnold versus Bancorp, but no one cited it in their briefs, so maybe I'm the only one that sees the similarities. But in that case, where there were also disclosure claims, it was suggested that there should have been a disclosure that $300 million was offered for one component when the final deal was for $275 million. And then there was some back and forth about whether there would be an amicus brief in this case about the implications of having the disclosed negotiations. But my question is, is your theory really one of partial disclosure that to the extent you were going to be, that these disclosures were going to be made, there should have been a disclosure that somewhere along the line there was the opportunity to close the deal without a premium, and that omission is similar to Arnold versus Bancorp. It's something that would have been material and people would have wanted to know about.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and even more so in this particular circumstance, because unlike the Arnold case, it's our contention that what we're seeing today after the transaction closed was the deal, the rejection, the disclosure we're talking about actually occurred. It was a quid pro quo. A premium was paid. Shareholders had their shares diluted, and critically, for purposes at least of the nominal damage argument, and what you know what the court meant in Malone, and what we say we agree with the court's reasoning, court chancery's reasoning in the O'Reilly case, that there wasn't an opportunity to make a informed vote on a transaction that affected the economic and voting rights of the shareholders. They're deprived of the right to make an informed vote, which is separate and distinct from the issue of the voting power dilution.
So if we stay with the Arnold analogy, then we don't have to worry about the adverse implications of a precedent decision to disclose negotiations. As I understand it, that you agree that to the extent the negotiations were disclosed in this case, they're incomplete.
That's correct, Your Honor. The reason why we challenged the Business Roundtable's attempt to file an amicus brief because we felt very strongly that it was a red herring. It didn't add anything in the sense that the sky was not falling. In this particular case, you've got partial disclosures. You have a lot of disclosure about the negotiations that went back and forth. This certainly should have been disclosed under the theory we've now embraced that there was disclosure of this secret negotiation, not so secret negotiation to the board. that should have been disclosed as well because there was discussion of what the board considered or did not consider. But importantly, the disclosure that we're challenging here, we claim, was in a sense the underlying loyalty violation. It was an issue where shareholders would find it important to know whether the chief executive officer, the chairman of this combined entity, was negotiating in good faith and at arm's length, and whether he was getting some benefit out of this transaction at the expense of the shareholders. So it's not a situation where we're taking on the issue of should pre-merger discussions or conversations or offers to purchase should be disclosed. There are numerous cases from this court and the court chancery that say that sometimes these things are too preliminary and there's absolutely no duty in, to disclose. And
help me understand, going back to my earlier question, how we get to Harrison being solely responsible for this problem. You know, if the board is no longer in the case and we have a corporate document that's being issued, your theory is that all of the responsibility and the liability should fall on Harrison. Is there any precedent for that?
Well, I think under the notion of joint and several liability, I would argue, even if the other board, the whole board was involved in this case, that the, if not the lion's share, almost everything, all liability would really go and accrue to Harrison. The reason I say that is I'm sure that if the case went to trial and the whole board was involved, you know, an argument would be developed on joint and several liability that the board said, well, look, we didn't prepare... We didn't have a role in preparation of the proxy documents.
Your wrongful act caused us to disseminate improper proxy materials. Therefore, if we're held liable, you should indemnify us. And you're just saving the board from going through that exercise.
That's correct. And we think that because he was the, since he was the beneficiary, of this undisclosed secret deal, he should bear the lion's share of the liability. The liability here may very well be one of unjust enrichment, in which he returns maybe 3 years worth of or 2 years worth of compensation that he received. Because if a court goes, if we go to a nominal
damage part of your damage claim,
well, it's possible because if the court goes to
how could it be possible? We're talking about a disclosure violation, for which you're claiming either nominal damages or share dilution damages. What does that have to do with the 3 years of salary and other benefits?
Well, it's a partial, I'm suggesting it as a partial alternative damage recovery. Let's say an expert comes along and opines that the voting power dilution was nominal. Let's say it really wasn't significant. And let's say there was a larger benefit that accrued to Harrison by virtue of the fact that he stayed on for 2 years.
Aren't you conflating the transaction damages with the disclosure damages, something you're not permitted to do since you didn't appeal from the substantive rulings of the court below?
No, I don't think I am, because it's our view that the economic injury that accrued here accrued only to the former JPMC shareholders and not to JMPC. Its totality, because if there was a derivative
in answer to my question, you agree that the two issues on this appeal are whether there's an entitlement to nominal damages as a consequence of any breach of the duty of disclosure, and secondly, whether there's an entitlement to compensatory damages flowing from share dilution as a consequence of the disclosure. Now,
well,
I don't know, that's the universe. Then I don't know where this third theory comes from, and it confuses the argument. It's not in your brief.
Well, let me clarify it if I can, because there's certainly the voting power dilution issue as well, not only just the economic injury, the voting power dilution. You know, what's that worth? That's something that has to be evaluated. And what I'm saying is that I'm looking, and I'm thinking about, in my mind, I'm thinking about TriStar. I'm thinking about what the court said in TriStar. Where TriStar...
Well, let's stop for a minute. Do you stand by your answer to my first question? The universe of damages, which is the issue I gather we're dealing with, are those two categories?
I would say, no, Your Honor, if I may, nominal damages, Category 1, and Category 2 are compensatory damages in the sense of either voting power dilution, which is different from the right to cast an informed vote, but voting power dilution, and the dilution with respect to the economic injury. Excuse me, economic damages. Economic damage, the voting power dilution, and then there's the right to cast an informed vote, which we think the right to cast an informed vote is properly considered part of the entitlement to per se damages.
You're not contending, are you, that a violation of the duty of disclosure entitles you to recover transaction damages, where the transaction damages already been held to be derivative?
No, Your Honor. The transaction damages would not be recoverable because we've already conceded it's derivative. What we're saying here with
the transaction damages is measured or are measured by the amount of shares, I gather, by the amount of the premium, which includes the shares that you contend should not have been issued.
Potentially.
I mean, how do you divorce
potentially. I think that getting back to the whole notion of Thule, the notion of what do you look at in terms of determining whether something is derivative or direct. And if you have two alternative theories, both of which permit you to certain measures of damages, because one theory, an attack on the transaction, is deemed derivative in nature, doesn't necessarily mean that same damages or quantum of damages, I should say, would be recoverable in the connection with a disclosure violation. And again, on the disclosure point, it's our argument that the JPMC shareholders, the former JPMC shareholders, not shareholders of the combined entity, would be able to recover for the loss, for the overpayment. That money could not possibly flow into the corporation in a derivative case because the Bank One shareholders would basically be recovering twice.
Which is why, isn't it, that the Vice Chancellor said the remedy for your disclosure claim, if any was merited, would have been equitable in nature, pre-transaction closing.
Well, I completely disagree with that holding of the court. Number one, I believe it's completely inequitable. I mean, first of all, on the specific facts of this case, the disclosure was made over a month after the shareholder vote and literally 3 or 4 days before the transaction closed. For us to have gone into court and got a TRO, I frankly think is highly impractical. There's the issue of bonding. There was the issue of the court's, you know, as you can see it throughout the opinion, skepticism of the underlying case. I don't think we can be faulted for not running into court and seeking a TRO. This is not a case where you have cases like Loudon and others where there's been years that go by while transactions being or disclosures being contested. I mean, by the fortuity of this coming out on a Sunday before the deal closed, I think is important. If it happened the day after the transaction closed, under the reasoning of the Vice Chancellor, we'd wind up with absolutely no remedy. It's too late. You couldn't get an injunction. The deal's closed already, and you're out of luck. And you can't. By the way, you can't recover damages, at least with respect to the voting power dilution and the lack and the failure. Excuse me. The inability to cast an informed vote. Those are lost because it's too late. You could have gotten an injunction, but now you can't. So I think this case has to be examined in its specific context and facts, and also the fact that the defendants were on notice of this lawsuit when it was filed. They're aware of its existence when it was filed. They're the ones who chose to go forward with the transaction. They proceeded at their own risk, and they were not, and have not to this day, denied the truthfulness of the truth of our allegations. So, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer.
So the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Transition, and that transition has proceeded more smoothly than it had been intended. anticipated. Now, Mr. Rogrodzki conceded, as he was appropriate to do, that in the argument before the vice chancellor, the plaintiffs conceded that their claim was that the directors of JPMC had been informed of this alleged no premium offer and had rejected it. That was conceded three different times. But it is also the allegation of the complaint. The complaint alleges in paragraph 79, the other individual defendants, those other than Harrison, breached their duty of loyalty by approving the merger solely to secure a benefit for Harrison. So that's the allegation of the claim. While they are proceeding on appeal only as to Mr. Harrison, I have no idea. I do not know. Now, let me address first the two claimed impacts on the plaintiff, the economic impact and the voting rights impact. They concede at page one of their reply brief that they have to allege a harm that is distinct from the harm suffered by their corporation as a result of the underlying claim of a breach of fiduciary duty. That's they say that they admit they have to allege a distinct harm. On the very next page of their brief, they say that the harm they suffered was that they, the plaintiff stockholders, were forced to pay a premium of $7 billion, an unnecessary premium, an exorbitant. Well, they, the plaintiff stockholders, didn't pay anything. That was paid by the corporation, and that's why, if there is a claim, it is a claim of the corporation. Their economic harm is really the inability to have voted for a better deal, the so-called no premium deal. Now, there was no premium deal. The assertion that there was is based on four assumptions, one of which is demonstrably incorrect by their own pleading, the other three of which are speculative. The one that's demonstrably incorrect is that the board would have voted for it. The board, it is alleged in the complaint, had turned down that deal. But it also assumes that the board of Bank One would have foregone a premium of $7 billion to its own shareholders. It assumes that the financial advisor of Bank One would have foregone or would have expressed an opinion that the transaction was fair, even though the shareholders were receiving $7 million less, billion dollars less. And finally, it assumes that the Bank One shareholders would have foregone the premium that would have been paid to them. Now, I submit that a lost opportunity that is based on that succession of demonstrably incorrect and speculative assumptions simply cannot serve as a basis for a damage claim, compensatory or nominal. Turning now to the voting rights, the dilution of voting rights. The comparison that Mr. Rogrodzki makes between the percentage ownership of the pre-merger J.P. Morgan Chase shareholders in the combined entity, 58%, and the percentage ownership that they would have had if this no premium deal had been accepted, is not what the courts of the state speak of when they talk about a dilution of shareholder interest. When they talk about a dilution of shareholder interest, they're talking about a comparison between the interests of certain pre-merger shareholders and the interests of other pre-merger shareholders. That, for example, in the TriStar case, which is a rather classic example of the single largest shareholder with 36%, engineering a series of transactions that brought its ownership to 80%, and the public shareholders, who had previously owned 46%, were reduced to 20%. And as Justice Jacobs, then sitting in the Chancery Court, said, that the distinguishing factors of a dilution claim, the distinguishing factors are a decrease in the voting power of public shareholders and a corresponding increase in the voting power of a significant shareholder. Here, the relevant voting rights of all pre-merger JPMC shareholders remained the same. This case is much more like a case called Paxson, where there was also a dilution claim, but it resulted from the fact that shares were issued to a third party, NBC, and just as the JPMC shareholders, excuse me, the Bank One shareholders were a third party here. And this is what the Chancellor said in dismissing the claim. To the extent any alleged decrease in the voting power of plaintiff shares results from the issuance of new shares to a third party, NBC there, Bank One shareholders here, plaintiff's dilution theory as a basis for a direct claim fails. Now, I'd like to turn to the argument which the plaintiffs make that they're entitled to recover nominal damages even if there was no economic impact upon them, even if there was no dilution of their voting rights. I respectfully submit that is not the law of the state. There were three cases from which I think one extrapolates the law on that subject: TriStar, Loudon, and Malone. In TriStar, this court held that Delaware law and policy have evolved into a virtual per se rule of damages for breach of the fiduciary duty of disclosure. Now, in Loudon, the court reviewed that holding and limited TriStar to its facts, and at three different points in the opinion said that in a corporate transaction that has, and I'm quoting now, and I quote with emphasis for a reason I'll explain, that has in turn caused impairment of the economic or voting rights of stockholders, there must be at least an award of nominal damages. Well, I submit, I've demonstrated, I hope to the court's satisfaction, that there's been no impairment to the economic or voting rights of the pre-JPMC shareholders. Now, it has been suggested that that holding of Loudon, square holding, was modified or overruled in the Malone case, which was rendered by this court 1 year later. In the Malone case, the issue was whether there was a breach of disclosure claim that could be founded upon a series of overstated financial statements that had been issued by the corporation. It was not in connection with a request for stockholder action. There was no such request. That case is very clearly different from this, in which there was a stockholder action requested and given, and that is the crux of how this merger came to be. Second, the citation in Malone to Loudon was in a footnote, that footnote elided from the quoted statement the language that I emphasized earlier. A transaction that has in turn caused impairment to the economic or voting rights of stockholders. There is no reason to believe that the court in Malone, in a truncated footnote quotation from a unanimous en banc decision a year earlier, was intending to overrule or to modify the rule of law set forth in that earlier decision. Finally, in Malone, the court sent the case back to the Chancery Court. for leave to assert a derivative claim. Well, the plaintiffs have asserted a derivative claim here. They misnamed it below, but the court, the vice chancellor, held it was a derivative claim, and that ruling is not on appeal. I think Loudon and Malone can both be read as supporting the proposition that a plaintiff who alleges an adverse economic impact of some kind or an impairment of voting rights need not prove quantifiable damages in order to recover nominal damages. The function of nominal damages is to award the plaintiff some relief when equitable relief is not practicable and although the plaintiff has suffered an economic harm, it cannot be quantified by proof of whatever kind, including expert testimony. Now, denying the plaintiff's nominal damages does not mean that in this case they were without any remedy. They could have sought interlocutory relief. Indeed, they could have sought relief in the 2 or 3 days before the closing, not by an immediate request for a TRO. There was really only one issue, and that was there any probative evidence, competent evidence, to support the triple hearsay statement in the New York Times that two sources had said that Diamond had said that he would forego a premium for his shareholders if he could become CEO immediately. They could have requested immediate disclosure of documents. They could have requested that Mr. Harrison and Mr. Diamond come down and testify in court. But they didn't do so. Why didn't they do so? Well, they really wanted to pursue that damage claim. And even if they were remitted to nominal damages, the only nominal damages that they have suggested anywhere before this court or the Chancery Court would be $1 a share, a mere $2.08 billion. Even if this court were to hold that the other elements of a shareholder disclosure claim for damages were present, damages either nominal or compensatory, it should affirm the decision below on a ground that the Vice Chancellor didn't reach, and that is that the omitted information was not material as a matter of law. The lost opportunity to acquire Bank One without paying a premium was, as I've indicated, far too speculative to have merited disclosure, and indeed, because of its speculative quality, it would have been misleading to disclose that position taken in the negotiations by Mr. Diamond. There is absolutely no law requiring that intermediate positions taken in negotiations be disclosed in a merger proxy statement. In the Santa Fe case in 1955, the court said that an abortive transaction with another company need not have been disclosed in a merger proxy statement with the third company. I was trying to read the Arnold case, which Your Honor mentioned while I was sitting at the table, and I'm afraid I didn't get through far enough to see whether it was, in our view, would be probative here. But there are other cases. There's a Siliconis case.
Well, in Arnold, it was a partial disclosure case. Even the court concluded one thing was material, but it concluded that something else that was alleged to be material was not material. So there's something in Arnold for everyone.
I certainly don't want this case to come out that way. There's also a very persuasive decision by the Court of Appeals, the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, in Beaumont versus American Can Company, which we have cited to the court and quoted from, I believe. Now, if the court were to hold that the kind of statement that Mr. Diamond is reported to have made has to be disclosed, and one can think of a lot of other statements that I'm sure were discussed at points in the negotiations, the composition of other members of senior management, whether the headquarters should be in Chicago, where Bank One was located, or in New York, where Chase was located. If there were going to be a transition between Mr. Diamond and Mr. Harrison, should it be after 2 years, or 3 years, or 1 year? All those intermediate give and take, the feint and counterfeint, the thrust and the parry of negotiations, if they were all disclosed, then the shareholders would be buried with information in a proxy statement. They would be buried with information which, in many instances, would be misleading, as it would have been here. It would breed litigation over whether positions that were taken in negotiations and not pursued should have been pursued, because if they'd been pursued, then it would have been a benefit to the shareholders. And it would place the parties in negotiations in absolutely impossible positions, because any statement they made, any trade that they proposed, could be brought back to haunt them and subject them to the kind of liability that the plaintiffs here would like to impose on Mr. Harris. Thank you.
Alleges that Mr. Diamond made an offer to Mr. Harrison. Mr. Harrison rejected it. The notion that what I'm hearing from counsel for the defense is, well, maybe Diamond didn't mean it, or maybe Diamond said it, but the shareholder of the Bank One never would have approved it. These are not proper considerations for purposes of dismissing a complaint on the pleadings. We're entitled to all reasonable inferences, and the fact of it being said and the fact of it being rejected are what's at issue in this, and at stake in this case. I'd like to direct the court and place specific emphasis on the issue of nominal damages, because this case seems to implicate the issue of what did Loudon say, what did Malone say, and whether, as a matter of law, there is a cause of action for the breach of fiduciary duty of disclosure explained in Malone as a situation where shareholder action is being sought, and especially here in the context of a merger where a shareholder vote is mandated by statute, whether nominal damages are available without a showing of causation and economic injury. Malone was clear at page 12 in saying an action for a breach of fiduciary duty arising out of disclosure violations in connection with the request for stockholder action does not include the elements of reliance, causation, and actual quantifiable monetary damages. The court in TriStar explained in footnote 12, in distinguishing between voting power dilution and the right to cast an informed vote. Let's see if I have time.
I think we'll take your arguments from the brief. Thank you very much, counsel. The case will be under advisement.